call problems as the handset is trying to figure out who it's talking to, you know?
Now, if I knew the main frequency region of my particular cell phone service, let's assume it was 800 megs, and on the roof of my house I build by, even by way of the inexpensive Yagi technique that's in the website by WA5VJB.com, WhiskeyAlpha5VJB.com, he'll show you how to make very inexpensive Yagis out of coat hanger wire and slats of wood. As many elements as you want, as much gain as you want, and of course you're about a dollar to do it. So if I was smart enough to build a high gain Yagi at 800 megacycles on my roof, aim it at the main cell site that's near me. So now I know I'm getting a potent signal into that antenna. And that goes into a piece of RG6 or RG58 or whatever cable that comes down inside the house. Then the simple monopole in the house, because the signal coming in through that Yagi is so potent, I don't have to stand as close to that monopole in the house to get reliable cell phone coverage. So once you realize the whole link is dependent on the gain of the antenna on each end, and whether or not one of those antennas is well aimed at a cell site and at a good altitude, I can now definitely increase the number of square feet in the house where I can walk around and get good cell site coverage. WB2QGZ for any comment. K2LIW in the TechNet.
You can, and you bring up a valid point, which reminds me of something else here now. Yeah, and you can. Look, I've used in a previous life, beam benders at 6-7 gigahertz. That effectively gave me a link I couldn't use before. And when you do the link budget, you actually end up with a little bit better signal to noise than if that device wasn't there and it's 100% passive. So yep, that's just another version of the same thing. The problem is with almost everybody's handset, you'll have stuff in 700 megahertz, 800 megahertz, 1800, 1900 paired channels, which is PCS, and 1700 megahertz, 2100 megahertz, which is paired, what they call AWS. And some carriers have data kind of half duplex at 2.6 gigahertz, I believe. So the problem is when you build one of your, without building a couple of these devices, you build one, for 17 up, 21 down, and the cell site decides, well, you know what, because of traffic or something else, I'm gonna move you over to this other band and potentially even another technology. In other words, I thought you were going to be good on voice over LTE, but you're not, so I'm going to bang you back to UMTS on another band. Now, you don't have that same path. That same path doesn't exist because you don't have a 700 megahertz antenna built up on your facility. So it's kind of, you'd have to think of it from the point of view of every band that your phone could possibly use.
You bring up a very interesting difficulty, Bill. But for the really smart amateur, this is not a showstopper. First of all, I may do enough of a research to find out that my cell phone uses 1800 megs 80% of the time, 2100 megs a certain percent of the time, 800 megs a certain percent of the time, and I decide which one of those are the most important ones, and for one, two, or three of those frequency regions, I build a separate Yagi for each one of those frequencies. And if I'm really smart, I can get these three Yagis all aimed at the appropriate cell sites for those particular frequency regions, all being connected together with a high-pass filter, low-pass filter, band-pass filter, into one common piece of coax cable that comes down into the living quarters of the house. So, I didn't say it's easy, but the technology is there to build the antennas for multiple directions of arrival, multiple frequency regions, all coming down to one piece of cable, and multiple pieces of cable if you want to be the Cadillac approach. And so, I could still do that. It's just a little bit more work, but if I've got a really major house, and I'm a frugal guy and don't want to buy a whole lot of these extra services, and I want passive repeating, which is what I'm describing, it's a possible way to go. You and I could consider doing that, and once we solve the problem, maybe we should publish an article on the idea, Bill. WB2QGZ, K2LIW in the TechNet.
You know, you can go out and buy multi-band panel antennas now if you have money in your pocket.
Okay, so you can write a check and make the problem go away, or if you're a frugal guy who just loves the technology of building it with his own hands, you can build it. possibility is there. Let's see what Bill thinks about all this. You got it, Bill. K2LIW.
What you can do, you know, it is possible to have a Yagi that functions from 1700 to 2200 megahertz, because, you know, obviously that's what you need to do if you're using AWS channels with a Yagi. I have a couple of those around here. And as it happens, it pretty much works through the whole band, so the BCS subset of 1800 to 1900 megahertz falls in the middle, so shouldn't be difficult to do that with one antenna. You just need a second Yagi for 700, and you'd probably be all set. But, you know, you say if you have a big house, in the case of most 40, 50, 60,000 square foot houses, yeah, you know, in Southampton, East Hampton, whatever, pretty much you just get up and bellow on the phone, and eventually find its way over to me, and I show up with a handful of gear, so. but sure, it's not impossible. Being that most people have Wi-Fi cooking already, that's a pretty quick way to do that, though, and that way you can tailor up the coverage in your house as well as you want. You know, you can buy some aftermarket antennas and plug into there, and you know, put the antennas up in two areas of the house, or you know, something like that. That's a pretty quick way to get that cooking.
While I'm on that URL, that website of Kent, Whiskey Alpha 5, Victor Juliet Bravo, you go to that website and he sells you printed circuit antennas, any frequency range you want. He's got a number of products there that are log periodic antennas that can cover everything from 450 megahertz up to 10 gigahertz. Not necessarily in one antenna, but he's got log periodics that will cover, I think, every one of the cell site frequencies all at once, one single antenna, with around 6.5 dB of gain. You aim that in the right direction on a rooftop operation, you get a big leg up on getting strong signal into the house. If you want to go the next step on that, you build an array of two or four of those. You build a phased array of log periodics. It sounds elaborate. The antenna I'm talking about is a piece of printed circuit board that's about 5 inches square. And to put up an array of these 5-inch printed circuit boards, all mounted to a simple wire frame aimed in the right direction, giving you a potent signal across all of that frequency, all coming down to one cable. That's one way to go. Now, when it comes to the more elaborate approach, let me drop. Right after we talk to Matt, KC2YDT, the next guy on our list is Rich, K2UPS. And on his UPS truck, where he drives from New Jersey to Kentucky or New Jersey to Chicago, many days of the week, and on a cell site, on a cell phone-like service, as he goes through those various towns and various services, various brand names, he's able to essentially completely talk to us continuously from his cab while driving in a hands-free manner. He's able to talk to us over this repeater and over the other 450 repeater of this frequency region. So we're going to have Rich give us a little bit of an explanation as to how he does that. Fascinating subject. Thank you for all of the above. Let's go over to Matt, who we've been keeping him waiting. KC2, WDT. YDT, WDT. You know who you are, Matt. K2RIW, you got it, Matt.
Okay, thanks again. KC2YDT. I recently got a very good Christmas gift for the holidays. I got the Yaetu 991. That's a brand new all-mode HF, and it has C4FM capable on 2 meters. I'm looking at different HF antennas. I'm looking to upgrade, you know, over at HRU. And there was one in particular that really caught my eye for out east. And that was the Chameleon Skyloop antenna. I like keeping things stealthy, especially out there, because it's, you know, in Quag, you know, there's a lot of antenna restrictions, et cetera, due to the fact we're so close to, you know, the 106 Air Westwood. I was wondering if anyone had any use with that antenna, or if they know any other, you know, good, you know, stealthy antennas that I should look into. K2IW, KC2IDT.
Okay, before I throw it open to the net for giving you suggestions, Matt, I'm not quite sure now what you're looking for. Are you saying the Chameleon Skyloop antenna looks like it fulfills all your requirements? Are you trying to find an antenna that works from 80 meters through 70 centimeters inclusive, maybe even 1296? So what frequencies do you want to cover, and how stealthy do you want the antenna to be? Are you trying to squeeze it into a couple of square feet? Do you want it to be invisible? So give us a couple of the parameters as to what frequency you're looking for, and how stealthy you want it. KC2YDT, K2LAW in the TechNet.
Okay, yeah, from 80 to 70 centimeters, preferably. And you know, I'm looking for, you know, where, you know, if I put it out in the backyard, you know, obviously I'll see it, you know, but you know, not to the point where it's going to, you know, catch people's eyes, you know, that, you know, don't know about antennas, et cetera, et cetera. The Chameleon Skyloop, the one I'm looking at, it's pretty much like a full-wave loop antenna. And, you know, it has, you know, it has some different parameters on it. And a lot of space, a yard of 60 by 80, you know, to install that antenna properly, which I have out there. So, that's what I'm looking at.
Now, when it comes to an antenna being stealthy and hard to see, there's at least two different ways of looking at that. A ham radio operator is looking for wire. He's going to see it right away. The majority of the average public, wire up in the air, they don't see it. I mean, up and down every single one of our streets, we've got all kinds of utility poles every 150 feet with all kinds of wires on it. It's been there from the year one, so to speak, and we got so used to it, we don't even see it anymore unless an automobile strikes one of those utility poles. So wire you don't see, and therefore a guy can put up a one wavelength loop wire antenna, dipole-like antennas, fan dipole antennas. And so for most of the HF frequencies, that works rather well and doesn't give you a lot of visibility, as long as you got a local tree you can mount it to nearby. And whether or not the antenna is whether that whole antenna assembly of a fan dipole-like thing is slanted at a 45-degree angle like a sloper. The average guy gets scared of that, and it works like a charm. All the pictures we see of a dipole, it always looks like a completely flat object parallel to the ground, high in the air with a feed line in the center. That's not the way you have to construct it at all. You can feed one end of a vertical piece of wire that's one wavelength long, a half wavelength long, and feed the outer edge with just an impedance matching device, an LC network. And you can do that in multiple bands with a switching network if you're a little bit smart. So there's ways of putting up high-performance wire that's hard to see to the average citizen. When you start buying a composite antenna, a ground plane-like antenna, now you've got a lot of shiny metal with all kinds of doodads on it, and its invisibility goes away real fast. So those are my original thoughts on that. When it comes to a high-performance antenna on 2 meters and 70 centimeters, low-performance dipoles work like a charm, as long as you're talking to fairly close-by repeaters. But if you want to talk to on an all-band rig on sideband, you want to talk to guys further away, you're going to want a Yagi. Well, a 2-meter Yagi and a 450 Yagi starts showing quite a bit more metal. Let me drop it. But in my case, there's a way you can get around that. If you go to the Anchor Paint Company, I can tell you what model number of paint they will sell you, which has got the exact same color as the bark of an oak tree. So in the wintertime, when you've got a whole bunch of oak trees on your property, and you make your antennas painted the exact same color, they become quasi-invisible. whereas you put up a shiny, brand new piece of galvanized steel or aluminum, it's going to show up like a sore thumb real fast. And the average guy thinks that paint on an antenna is going to hurt the performance. Absolutely not. I mean, the paint is a couple thousandths of an inch thick. It's a 1/10,000th of a wavelength of thickness, no matter what the hell you made the paint out of. No matter how lossy, conductive, or non-conductive it was. It's an extremely minor, thin layer of material that doesn't affect the RF at all. Unless you happen to make the paint out of a conductive substance and you bridge an insulator with it. I mean, other than some silly thing like that, there's ways of making antennas invisible, as you can tell. Anybody with any further suggestions from that for stealthy antennas on 80 through 70 centimeters, even in various bands as opposed to one composite antenna, got any suggestions? Give us your call letters right now. K2RAW in the TechNet. Looks like you got a fairly stiff requirement there. Nobody's got an immediate response for you yet, Matt. That chameleon sky loop, what frequency regions do they claim it covers? And give us a quick physical description. What does it look like? KC2YDT, K2RAW the TechNet.
K2IW, K2IW. Okay, it says it covers, from 3.0 to 54 megahertz so it should cover the majority of the HF frequencies, if anything, if all of them. It seems very nice. The other thing which I'm doing, for here over in New Hyde Park, is I'm going to be throwing up a chameleon version 1 antenna. And that's almost like a vertical, but it has I really can't describe it off of the top of my head. It has almost like a oval type base that goes completely around it. Now, I have a friend who uses that for portable operations, not high at all, maybe 13 feet high off the ground, and he works inland with it. So I'm planning on getting that and throwing that up on the chimney, and then just running a long wire for 80 and 40.
Yeah, right now I'm looking at a picture of the Chameleon Skyloop antenna, and it looks like it's a fairly low visibility thing. It shows you a picture of it alongside of a house. It looks to me like it's mostly wire, and people don't see wire. I'm kind of amazed by that, but people don't see wire. Most people that are your residents nearby, rarely look up in the air. You can prove that to yourself by taking all of your friends that visit you and to find out whether or not they look up in the air while they're inside your house. Ask them, what's the color of the shingles on my house? Most of them can't answer that question because they don't look up in the air. When they're walking across your property, across your lawn, across your yard, your driveway, your front lawn or whatever, they're looking at where they're walking. They don't look up in the air. Only hands look up in the air. So, looks like it's going to require a little bit more research. Sounds like you're pretty happy with that Yaesu 991. Roughly how expensive is that? It sounds like a very new rig, Matt. And I think you're telling me that covers 80 through 70 centimeters. KC2YDT, K2RAW, how long have you had it?
Well, the Yaesu 991 is what I got for Christmas from my parents. It's actually not out yet through HRO. They're expecting to receive it at their stores sometime next this upcoming week. They said it was in the U.S. It arrived this week, actually. That covers everything. It covers all HF. Covers 2 meters, 70 centimeters. It has C4FM capabilities and a lot of auto functions built into it. It's the newest model that Yaesu came out with. and I'm pretty sure it's roughly around $1,700.
On the HF frequencies, is that in the vicinity of 100 watts of output on that?
QSL puts out 100 watts on HF, 50 on VHF and UHF. Just pulled it up. It has the features of it. Covers 160 through 6 meters, 2 meter and 70 centimeter. Handles single sideband, CW, FM, RTTY, PSK, C4FM. It has 32-bit high-speed floating point IFDSP. 160 through 6 meter built-in auto tuner, IF RIF and IF SIFT, contour and IF knots, and CF output. That's just some of the features that it has.
Yes. Boy, that is fancy. Hal recognized, but a quick question for you, Matt. You keep talking about C4FM, Charlie 4FM. What does that stand for?
Okay, if Eric is still on frequency, he could answer that. That's that new, I don't know too much about it yet, but it's a new digital voice that LineMark is in the process of putting into the repeater if it's not in already. It's the system fusion. I know LineMark does own one radio that goes around to different board members currently that has that. So if Eric is on frequency, he can give you a little bit more information on that.
Okay, I'm going to pick up Hal and then Eric in that order on my subject. K6DPZ, Hal, go right ahead with your information. K2RIW in the TechNet.
2RIW in the TechNet, K6DPZ. It's very funny. I have a comment about the channel, but first of all, I'll say, I was sitting here. I have an 817 sitting on the island of my kitchen here in Oceanside. I'm hearing the TechNet beautifully. I've been trying to get in since 8 o'clock, and nobody yet recognized me. When I look it back, the antenna is cable is disconnected from the mag mount. The receiver is so sensitive, an antenna didn't even enter into the equation. And I thought, being was working so well, that the radio was connected to this little mag mount I had. Okay, I just wanted to say, I run, until I got all my antennas up here, which are still in the process, a 33-foot wire coming down from my second floor, with just a random wire tuner and just counterpoint to the AC plug, 100 watts, and I worked 160 through 10 meters, and on 20 I worked all over the world. So 33 foot wire, and it was just a slope from my ranch, high level ranch, down to a tree, which I tied the wire to, a branch. I worked beautifully. So if conditions are right, you don't need a big antenna. The whole thing is matching it and let it radiate. Go ahead there, K2RIW. This is T6 Darling Purple Zombies.
That's a good piece of information, Hal. And that 33-foot piece of wire that works on all of your HF bands, you're feeding that by way of a rather wide range antenna tuner. And I think you said you're putting 100 watts into it. What brand of tuner do you like, Hal, that has enough range to do that? And even if at worst the tuner runs out of range on one of those bands, by making a minor change in the length of the wire, I think you could adjust that. K6DPZ, K2RIW.
2RIW, K6DPZ. Would you believe I had just a rotary inductor of 22 microhenries and a 400 pump capacitor? And just an L network. That's all it took. And I saw it wasn't tuning exactly right on 10. I put about 200 puffs in series with the antenna, and I nulled it out on 10.
Yeah, one of those rotary induct tuners. My goodness, can they? That was a variable air capacitor, 400 picofarad, I think you said. That's got a lot of tuning range. I'll bet you that roller duct, that rolling variable inductor, did that possibly come out of a piece of an ARC 5 equipment, Eric? Here we go, Hal, K6DPZ, K2RIW.
No, this one wasn't of an ARC 5, but I have used the roller inductor of an ARC 5. Many years ago, I was taking ARC 5's volume for next to nothing, and I was selling a L network tuner with the capacitors that were in the bottom of the ARC 5 and a rotary inductor. The thing matched basically from DC to light.
And whenever a person has any doubt as to whether or not it'll tune a particular frequency, by way of the Brown and Woodward curves, you can get a hold of the Brown and Woodward curves for any length of wire, any frequency in the world, any diameter of wire. You go to this curve and it'll tell you exactly what the resistive component of impedance is going to be and the reactive components. The Brown and Woodward curves are in Chapter 4 of almost every single issue of the Antenna Engineering Handbook. You can also get a copy of them by going to the Mike 2 website, which is technetlimarc.com, technetlimarc.com, and you look at the K2RIW dipole matching article. There you'll find a copy of the Brown and Woodward curves. Let me drop. So once you know the diameter of the wire, the length of the wire, the frequency you're at, you go to that curve, it'll tell you exactly what impedance you're going to get. And then if you want to be exacting about this, you go to the Berkeley website. You just Google the word Berkeley, B-E-R-K-E-L-E-Y, and impedance matching, and up pops this program where you tell it what is the impedance of your transmitter, probably 50 ohms, what's the frequency you're operating at, and what's the load that you're using. In other words, in this case, the antenna. What's the impedance of the antenna, resistive and reactive? You plug those numbers into the Berkeley website, and you press go, and you get 16 solutions. LC networks, CL networks, PI networks, T networks, LC PI, combinations of all of the above. You get 16 solutions. Choose the one you like. It'll tell you exactly how many microhenry you need and how many picofarads you need to make an impedance matching network that at least at that one frequency will give you a nearly perfect impedance match. So you can do it by cut and try, as Hal is describing with his roller induct tuner and a variable capacitor as a CL or an LC network, or you can do it exacting and know exactly what you're doing. Choose the method that you like, but the data is there. And if you want to wind your own coil, let me drop. If you happen to need a coil of 12 and a half microhenries, and you go to the early chapters of the antenna of the Radio Amateur's Handbook, you'll find in the reactant section, it'll tell you that if you wind a coil of this many inches of diameter and this much length and this many turns, you plug the numbers into that formula, and it'll tell you exactly how many microhenries you're going to get. So winding your own coil, building your own capacitor if you want to do it, it's all doable depending on how much you want to buy, how much you want to build. And with any further questions on broadband antenna impedance matching, give me a call that is right now, K2RIW the TechNet.
I want to say one more thing. I'm very busy here, but I want to mention one thing. It's okay.
You got it, Hal.
It was discussion about cell sites earlier. I tried to get in. A big situation with the cell site, if the cell site has a lot of usage, the time backup system they have of batteries will not last that long compared to cell sites that are further out in more rural areas where the duty cycle of the cell site is not as much. That's number one. Number two, if you want to make a rotary inductor coil, and you don't have a rotary inductor coil, what you can do is build a very simple varicoupler. You wind one coil with about 140 turns. You wind on one side diameter. Then you wind another coil, a smaller diameter, where the one coil will go into the other coil. But you have to wind the coil, other coil, out of phase, reverse. As you slide both coils together, it acts just like a rotary inductor. Your inductance will change, and you can match multiple frequencies with that and just a tuning capacitor, like a 365 It's low power, 365 micromite radio tuning capacitor. But a barrel coupler does not require the coil to be tapped or be on a rotary contact. One goes into the other, the inductance is canceled by virtue of the magnetic field. Go ahead, Dick.
Yeah, I think I got a picture of that, Hal. Those two coils are counter-rotated. One's clockwise winding, one's counterclockwise winding. One's built on a piece of a 2-inch diameter PVC tubing. The other one's built on an inch and a half, and you slide one into the other, and they're wired in series. Therefore, you make a fairly variable inductance. And if you've got some kind of a worm screw mechanism there, so you can precisely turn a crank and change the exact amount of penetration of one coil into the other. Has anyone ever written an article on that? That's a beautiful technique, Hal. Do you know of a website that has an article showing a guy a picture of how to build that? K6DPZ, K2RIW?
2RIW, K6DPZ. I wrote an article, I submitted it to Electric Radio. They never bothered publishing it with a model of the coil system and everything. And I'm still waiting. I gave the article about 5 months ago.
Now, I don't know if air ducts, wound inductors that used to be able to buy in a song from various electrical supply houses, I don't know if air ducts still exist, but buying two diameters of air ducts and putting some kind of a sleeve in between the two and mounting the thing horizontal on the table and just with your fingers sliding one into the other, it's not precise, but it would work. Does air ducts still exist? And is there a way that somebody could send you an email address by which they can get a copy of your article on how to do that, Hal? K6DPZ, K2RIW.
K2RIW, K6DPZ. In a month from today, when I have a little more time, Dick, I'm so busy now trying to assemble the station and do everything else in the business, it's hard for me to answer an SASE. But in a month or two from today, I'll be more than happy to send a copy of the article, you know, an explanation. And that can also be done if you want to make a random wire longer or shorter by sliding the inductors one into the other, as long as they're opposite phase, to change the electrical length of the random wire. It works.
Yeah, I can see how you don't want to get involved with self-addressed stamped envelopes and shipping all that paper to people. Maybe at some time downrange, you'll be able to scan that article, and therefore you send it to a guy as a as an enclosed PDF. That might be possible, Hal. Go ahead.
Dick, what I may do when I have a chance, I'll give you a copy of the article, and if you want to circulate it, there's no problem there at all.
Yeah, it's too bad that they wouldn't print that. Very similar to my article on getting a perfect impedance match of a dipole. Lots of people have read that article and said, boy, it's about time somebody tell me how to do that. And yet I can't get anybody to print it. They think dipoles are too elementary. Okay, we've been keeping Rich waiting for a long time. Rich, K2UPS.
Dick, by the way, Mike 2 could post that. That would make it convenient.
Yeah, we can put it on Mike 2's website. We're going to consider that. K2UPS, hope you're within range, Rich. And what state are you in? And you might want to give us a couple of words as to how, as you drive through all of these cities and all of these states and you go through these various services, you're able to still talk continuously on your cell phone into this repeater. I think some people would be rather fascinated as to how you've been doing that for the last year or so. K2, Uncle Papa Sierra, mobile. K2RIW in the TechNet.
K2UPS Mobile. Good evening, Dick and Annette. All right, now I just came through New Stanton, Pennsylvania. Made a transition from I-70 to I-76, and I am heading eastbound back to New York on the way home. And just using the Echolink app on my cell phone, I think a Bluetooth headset, so it's hands-free, and it works well. I have a Verizon for a carrier. I found that the area that I travel, mostly on the interstates, they have the most reliable coverage, fewest drop calls out of different ones that I've tried and my other friends have tried. So That's it as far as that goes. Let me let it drop and I'll tell you my question. My question tonight is on coaxial cable, particularly old coaxial cable. Not quite sure how old, but I have several lengths of roughly 50 to 100 feet long of two different types of an RG8. One is a Belden, I think, 8214, and the other is a 9913. I'm curious as to what tests I can do using what equipment to let me know if the coax is still viable for use for RF, particularly in HF frequencies, and going beyond just using a voltometer to check the continuity of the braid and the semiconductor and make sure that it's not shorted anywhere in there. I was talking to John earlier about this, but I'd like to hear what you have to say, and I think it might benefit some other people that maybe have some old stuff lying around too and wonder if it's still good. Back to that.
6DPC with a comment when you have a chat stick.
Okay, why don't you start off right now, Hal? You got it, Hal.
Okay, fast tests. Very simple tests. Get yourself the Miracle with one tube called a grid dip meter. You take a little 50 ohm resistor carbon, you tie it to the end of the cable at the other end. You put a little loop at the beginning end of the cable. You couple the grid dip meter in. And start off with the highest frequency that you have on the grid dip meter and go all the way down. And if you don't see a dip on the grid dip meter, the coax is fine. If you see a dip on the grid dip meter as you're going through the frequencies, stop the coax in the cam.
Yeah, that is a kind of a go-no-go test. But I know that Rich is a little bit more of a scientist, and I think he's going to want a quantitative answer. And he has the resources to beg, borrow, or he probably owns a bird watt meter. And even if the slug he owns doesn't go down to that frequency, maybe you've got a slug that goes down to 10 meters and you want to do a test at 80 meters, which means the slug is going to be a little bit less accurate. But by putting the coax cable between your transmitter and a known dummy load and or an antenna, the choice is yours, but anything that acts as a load, and at the power level, and by the way, whether you test the power handling, whether you test the insertion loss of the cable at 1 watt, 10 watts, or 100 watts, doesn't really matter. The insertion loss in dB is going to be the same. My favorite technique is to put the bird watt meter at the input end of the coax. Of course, you're going to look for forward power and reverse power to make sure the cable doesn't give you a high standing wave ratio. Then move the bird watt meter to the far end of the cable and measure forward power and reverse power again. The reverse power, of course, will be telling you the quality of your dummy load, but the forward power is what you care about. So if you put 10 watts into the input end of the cable, and at the output end of the cable you measure 8 watts, so to speak, then you know you've got 1 and a fraction dB of loss for that length of cable. That's a quantitative answer. My favorite answer is to find out exactly how many you're going to be making the measurement in watts, but you're going to convert it back into dBs of insertion loss by dividing one power into the other and taking 10 times the log of that. So once you know the dB of loss per cable, let me drop it. And your particular piece of cable might be 100 feet long. At your frequency region, maybe the manufacturer tells you it should have 3/4 dB per 100 feet of loss, and you measure 1 dB per 100 feet. You know that the cable has degraded a little bit, but for the average operation, 1 dB of loss in the cable, which is 1/6 of an S unit of a well-calibrated S meter on the other end that the guy you're talking to, that's the only difference he's going to see if you went from perfect cable to your particular piece of cable. So once you have a quantitative answer of how many dB loss the cable's got, you then can make a decision that, hey, the cable is pretty close to brand new condition, or boy, it's acting like it's really sucked up an awful lot of water. But even so, even if it's got 2 dB of loss, and it's something that's convenient for you to use now, and it's going to take you another week to get the real piece of cable in your hands, you can decide to go and use it, and it's not going to burn itself up with power dissipation because it's so lossy. And whether or not it's got a short circuit, open circuit, insertion loss, water, everything comes out all in one simple measurement by a watt meter in the input end and a watt meter in the output end. That's my favorite technique. I wonder if that makes some sense to you, Rich. K6UPS, K2RIW, the TechNet.
The one thing is I do not have a grid dip meter. I should. I know it's a good piece of equipment to have, that and a noise bridge, especially if you're just landing antennas. Both of those can come in really handy. Save yourself some grief. I do have an MFJ antenna analyzer, and talking to John, I think he suggested something similar to what Hal just did, by hooking the coax up to a, you know, good dummy load, and then sweeping it to different bands that you're going to be using it for, to see how what kind of readings you get there. That'd be, I guess, similar to using the get similar results as using the grid dip meter. Is that correct, Dick?
Yeah, Hal recognized. Since you already own the antenna tuner, you've got the ability to make an extremely good measurement. Put a known good dummy load at the far end of the cable. With your antenna analyzer at the input end of the cable, if the cable was perfect, you're going to see 50 ohms. And if you see 48 ohms to 53 ohms, don't worry about it. If the cable gives you a whole lot of inductance or capacitance on your antenna analyzer, then you know there's a whisker somewhere acting as a short circuit, an open circuit, or whatever. So as long as it's in the vicinity of 50 ohms, it's met the first test. The second test now is to put a pure open circuit or a short circuit at the far end of the cable. The advantage of the short circuit or an open circuit, it's your choice, is you know that the signal out of your transmitter is going to go down the cable, it's going to hit that short circuit or open circuit, none of it gets coupled into it, all of it gets reflected. Now the signal that comes back is your standing wave ratio. You're going to, by way of your antenna analyzer, you're going to find out what is the apparent standing wave ratio of that piece of cable that used to be a 1-to-1 standing wave ratio when you had a dummy load, but now with the open circuit or the short circuit, the standing wave ratio goes up to some particular number. I'm going to choose a number right now. Let me drop. I know for a fact that a piece of cable that has a short circuit or an open circuit that has 3 dB of loss will be a 5.8-to-1 standing wave ratio. I'll have to double check on that. But a 5.8-to-1 standing wave ratio, I think, represents 3 dB of loss. And right now I'm not quite sure if that's one way or two way. But there is a set of formulas I can derive for you. Probably we can find it in the Radio Amateur's Handbook. When the piece of cable at the far end has got a short or an open, and you know the VSWR, you know the loss of the cable. If the cable was absolutely lossless, you would, by definition, have all the power reflected. The standing wave ratio would appear to be infinity. That's a perfect piece of cable. If the cable is extremely lossy, you're going to see a 1-to-1 standing wave ratio. All the power going down the cable gets dissipated. None of it gets reflected. By measuring the standing wave ratio, that's telling you exactly what the reflection coefficient is on a two-way pass into that shorter and open circuit. That will give you a beautiful quantitative answer. You know the exact number of dB of loss in the cable. And the reason why you do it as a two-step, let me drop. The reason why you do it as a two-step, where one step is a good dummy load at the far end, and make sure it looks like it's approximately a 50 ohm piece of cable, and then the shorter and open, the reason for that is because if the cable had a shorted connector at one end or the other, particularly the input end, or a short somewhere in the middle of the cable, or an open circuit somewhere in the middle of the cable, if you did only a one-step test, particularly if the short circuit or open circuit was very close to the input end of the cable, you would measure a very high standing wave ratio. You would think you have a beautiful piece of cable, even though it's really an open circuit or a short circuit near the front end. So you do want to do a two-step test. But with that antenna analyzer, standing wave ratio and reflected voltage or reflected power ratio, there's a 1-to-1 relationship there with a fairly simple formula in between. Let's see what Hal's got to say on this one. K6DPZ, K2RIW, the TechNet.
2RIW and TechNet, oh, K6DPZ. Okay, you got an antenna analyzer. I'll tell you a very easy way to measure the loss on a piece of coax. Connect your antenna analyzer, the input cable, the termination 50 ohm resistor, dummy load, whatever, on the opposite side. Take a voltmeter with an RF probe and take a measurement of the voltage going into the cable from your antenna analyzer. Take a measurement of the voltage appearing across your 50 ohm terminated load. E squared divided by Z, or 50 ohms,
will give you a power reading. The differences in power from what's going in and going out can be calculated as dB loss. KQRIW, K6DPC.
As long as he's got a spare RF voltmeter, and with by way of a T connector at the input end and a T connector at the output end where the demi load is, that's another very good measurement. My favorite technique is the Bird wattmeter. My second technique is the Vizwar with the antenna analyzer, but exact voltage measurements going in and out is another very good technique. Not many amateurs own an RF voltmeter, but if Rich does, looks like you're down to at least three ways of testing this, Rich. I guarantee we can come up with four or five more. K2UPS in Pennsylvania, Mobile, K2RIW in the Tech Man.
Let me grab it one more second.
Yeah, go ahead, Al.
You have a digital voltmeter like a Fluke or any of those. You buy yourself an RF probe, which is very cheap, and use that for making your measurements because your MSK is going to put out voltage in volts, not millivolts. And RF volts and voltages like that, you can measure with an RF probe. You don't need a sophisticated RMS voltmeter. Go ahead, Dick.
Okay, what brand name is your favorite RF probe that'll go into a digital voltmeter? What's your favorite brand name and roughly how many bucks? And where do you buy it? K6DPZ, K2RIW.
K6DPC. Fluke makes a probe, but you really go in the amateur radio handbook, and you can make your own RF probe, build it in a pillbox. It takes a diode, a capacitor, and a resistor, and a shield of lead going to the meter, and you go down the road.
Okay, so I know by way of the club that you're a member of, Rich, lots of guys have got a Bird wattmeter you can borrow. You already have the antenna analyzer, and being as much of a scientist as you are, it would be a lot of fun to make the measurement input and output end with the Bird wattmeter, make the measurement by way of standing wave ratio with your antenna analyzer, and compare the two answers, and hopefully they come within a couple of percent of each other. And then consider building yourself an RF probe, which you'll be using in all kinds of experiments downrange. KTUPS, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Okay, thank you, Dick and Al, for the info. Definitely got some good ideas here to check out, and I'll be doing that probably Monday, Tuesday this week when I get back home again. So, appreciate the help. KTUPS Mobile, back to net.
Now, when you make those measurements, Rich, on the next TechNet, come back and tell us what you found. What did your cable look like? Did you see some green fuzz at one end of the cable because it was stored in the basement under some water? And by the way, it's kind of fun to take a really beat-up piece of cable that's been laying out in the mud outdoors for a while, or has been in the damp end of the basement for 10 years, and just for the hell of it, measure what is the insertion loss of the cable. Some of the old RG8 cable used to have what's called contaminating outer jacket, where something would leach out of the PVC, polyvinyl chloride, I guess it is, the juice would leak out of the cabinet, out of the outer jacket, go through the braid, make the braid get tarnished, and impregnate itself into the polyethylene of the cable. And as you go up in frequency, the loss increases. My favorite kind of... who is that?
N2, APG.
Go ahead, Dave.
Hiya, Dick. Just to play devil's advocate, if you didn't have any test equipment at all, and you wanted to check an unknown piece of cable that you had laying around, couldn't you just install it, compare it with a known piece of good cable, and just swap it out, put the unknown cable in there, and just compare your readings on your S-meter, on your receiver, to known signal strengths of stations, repeaters, friends, you know, things like that, and if there's any catastrophic problem with that cable, wouldn't that show up on the S-meter?
It sure would, Dave, but there's two problems here. Number one, to find a signal that has a known power output like a repeater on 2 meters, relatively easy. And for the length of time it takes you to swap out the cable, maybe 10 minutes, you'd like to believe that the power output to that repeater and the propagation between you and that repeater doesn't change very much in 10 minutes, and therefore that's a reasonably well-calibrated signal source. However, most of our receivers, the S-meter is really poor in calibration. If it was a mil-spec signal strength meter in our receiver, 50 microvolts should be S9 should be 50 microvolts. Each S unit below that is exactly 6 dB of change, and so on. You do a calibration test on your signal strength meter, and you'll find out that many S meters have not 6 dB between S units, 2 decibels between S units at the high end of the meter, and some other great big difference number at the low end of the meter. And even in the over S9, 10 dB over S9 and 20 dB over S9, sometimes those are really 5 dB instead of 10 and so on. So almost all of our receivers, unless you've done a separate procedure to calibrate your S-meter, you'll be very disappointed. Most of the manufacturers make sure the S-meter is not scotch. If the S-meter is really scotch, gives you low readings, you become an unpopular guy for people to talk to. They make sure the S-meter reads high, if you know what I mean. Therefore, there tends to be a very small number of dBs between the S-units on most of our S-meters. Let me drop. The only receiver I've ever found that had a reasonably linear signal strength meter was the Drake R4C. The good news is that the S-meter at the low end, the high end, and whatever, was reasonably linear. That's the good news. The bad news is that every one of those S units was 5 dB, not 6 dB, of difference between S units. I don't remember now when the plus 20, plus 40, plus 60 dB over S9, how bad those numbers were. So I have never found a receiver, not even a Collins, with a really well-calibrated S unit, S meter. Yes, it is a good relative reading. And by way of a step attenuator that you add to the receiving system, where you keep bringing the signal strength back to the same indication on the S-meter, you can get around that. But if you just read the raw readings of the S-meter, I think you can be pretty far out. Over to you, Dave, K2RIW.
Okay, well, I was just trying to shed a little light on the situation, you know, for those people that just don't have any sort of major test equipment. You know, there's still ways to test that piece of cable. You know, it's a layman's method, so to speak, to get an indication of if it's usable or not. And, you know, also, you got to look at what is your application going to be. If you're just going to put up an antenna and perhaps you're going to use 50 feet or less of cable and it's going to be on the low bands, it's probably not going to matter that much. Even if that cable has some loss, you know, maybe it's a little older, it's quite possible that it's still going to be very usable. So, just my 2 cents at 2APJ. Back to net. Thanks, sir.
I definitely agree with that one, Dave. You got to be careful how you rate loss. The average guy, if he had 3 dB of loss, a cable that's rated 2 dB per 100 feet, he's using 100 feet of it, he measures 3 dB, that's not a showstopper. 3 dB on a well-calibrated S unit, single strength meter, is half an S unit. And unless you're in the middle of a pileup and you're the one guy running QRP and you're trying to get through, and in most cases, 3 dB is not going to make a big difference. However, you get a guy who's got a third watt meter, and he puts 100 watts into one end of the cable, and he gets 50 watts out of the other end of the cable. That's the same 3 dB of loss, 2-to-1 power ratio. And he starts thinking to himself, boy, 50 watts of mine is being eaten up by that cable. Boy, that cable is terrible. You can easily fall into that trap. Or if you were doing the test at a kilowatt level, you put a kilowatt into one end, and you measure 500 watts out of the other end, the exact same piece of cable with the exact same 3 dB of loss. Now you can say to yourself, boy, I'm losing 500 watts. They're never going to hear me. You can really misunderstand the difference between wattage of loss And by the way, if he did the test at 1 watt, he'd measure half a watt at the other end. I'm only getting half a watt of loss. That sounds a lot better. It's the exact same cable, the exact same test. So you have to be a little bit careful how you rate it. I do recommend that when it comes to insertion loss of a cable, you boil it down to decibels of loss, because that's the way the manufacturer told you what the cable is supposed to do when it's brand new. And from that, you can make a judgment as to whether or not the cable is good enough for now and should you replace it later. Okay, the next guy who was on our list was John. Hope we haven't put him to sleep. Kilo, Kilo 4, Uncle Zulu Golf, if I got it right, John. K2RIW, you got it, John.
Come real fast before I get out of here, K6DPZ. I'm K2RIDT.
I've been keeping John waiting a long time. Let me pick up John first. KK4UZG, K2RIW, go ahead, John. Yeah, I was a little bit afraid of that. We kept John waiting so long that he maybe had to go away. So we're going to go to Hal and Matt in that order. K6DPZ, K2RIW, go ahead, Hal.
K2RIW in the tech, K6DPZ. Now, one other real fast way of checking losses in coaxial cables, if you do have access to a good signal generator, let's say, what you can do is do a substitution method. Take the signal generator, figure it into a receiver, use S9 as a reference. Then, after you get your reference, put your cable in. See how much higher you have to bring your attenuator to come up to S9. The amount of dB difference you're reading on your signal generator's attenuator is the insertion loss of the cable. K2RIW, K6DPZ.
Yeah, that's a very good way. And it's essentially traceable to the Bureau of Standards, so to speak. Because a well-made signal generator, the output step attenuator, even an old-fashioned Hewlett-Packard 608 signal generator, it's got the variable dial measured in both microvolts and dBs. Most well-made signal generators these days do have a very well-calibrated output indicator. So that's a good test. I like that one. Very quantitative. Let's see what Matt's going to say. KC2YDT. K2RIW. Go ahead, Matt.
Okay, this wasn't on that topic. I let it go earlier because I wanted to move on to the other station. But later on, you forgot to mention, you know, ask Eric about that C4FM technology.
Let's see if Eric is still with us. KE2EJ. Want to give us a few words on C4FM? K2RIW in the TechNet. I think it's a good chance that Eric went on to greener pastures, Matt. We'll eventually find out what that means. I know that I think Limark did buy or whatever, get on loan a Yaesu repeater, which had the C4FM capability to it. And I think they ran a test with that for a couple of weeks. Wonder if you were involved in that test, Matt. KC2YDT, K2RIW.
Negative. I wasn't involved in that. I do have a good colleague of mine, Jerry N2WGF, who does have a portable with that technology, the C4FM. And his comments on the whole thing was, you know, the audio quality is a tremendous difference over the analog signal. It sounds like you're talking right next to someone.
Interesting comment. So, we'll look forward to Eric describing that to us and whether or not it's going to catch on. I do wonder how many of our rigs are going to have that capability. And will it be supplied automatically, or do you have to buy it as an auxiliary object with an extra cost? So, in the mailbag this week, John, are they trying to stump us? They got some real good ones. KC2WGB, K2RIW, you got it, John.
KC2WGB, mailbag. Good evening, Derek.
everyone. Net Dick. Yeah, we got a couple of questions here. It's been a slow week. All right, let it drop, and I'll go on to this first one from Roberto.